Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with tomorrow's G7 summit in Quebec City, Canada, which President Trump is reluctantly attending because it is likely he will get an earful from the leaders of France, Germany, Japan, the UK and Canada, who, as America's allies, are furious that he's imposing tariffs on them and starting a trade war. Donald Abelson, a professor and chair of political science at the University of Western Ontario in Canada, who specializes in American politics and U.S. foreign policy, joins us to discuss the alarming ignorance of history displayed by Donald Trump in his testy phone call with Canada's Prime Minister Trudeau and Trump's State Department spokesperson, who cited the D-Day invasion as an example of America's, quote, very strong relationship with Germany. We'll review the list of world leaders and close allies such as Abe, May, Macron, and Trudeau, who have gone out of their way to court Trump and establish friendships with him only to be stiffed, and assess what the impact might be of a threat from France's President Macron to join with other world leaders at the G7 to issue a rare rebuke by excluding the US from the joint statement issue at the end of the summit. Then we'll examine further Trump's tariffs on allies and neighbors and the extent to which, because of anger at Trump from indignant populations in France, the UK, Germany, Japan, Mexico, and Canada, leaders of these countries will be forced to reciprocate and perhaps trigger a trade war. Rodrigue Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Montreal, who was president of the Canadian Economic Society and a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlement of the North America Free Trade Agreement, joins us to discuss Trump's revival of the nativist and isolationist stupidity which led to the Smoot-Hawley Act signed by President Hoover in 1930, which triggered a global depression. And since Trump is pandering to nativist protectionism in hopes of winning re-election in the Rust Belt in 2020, we will assess whether corporate America and the Congress will step up to prevent a looming trade war. Then finally, we will speak with Rabbi Joseph Berman, Government Affairs Manager at Jewish Voice for Peace, about the 50-46 vote in the Senate today to confirm Kenneth Marcus as Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights under Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, in what appears to be yet another example of Trump appointing someone who is implacably opposed to the mission they are charged with. We'll look into how the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act before Congress, which Kenneth Marcus champions, would prevent schools and colleges from supporting Palestinian rights or criticizing Israel because of the risk of losing federal funding and being branded as anti-Semites. And joining us now is Donald Abelson, who is a professor and chair of political science at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. He specializes in American politics and U.S. foreign policy, and his most recent book is Northern Lights, Exploring Think Tanks in Canada. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donald Abelson.
Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Donald. And as you know, the president had a very testy phone conversation recently with Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada, in which President Trump is reported to have said, "Didn't you guys burn down the White House?" A lot of historians, of course, have pointed to Donald Trump's sort of loose relationship with the facts in terms of history.
Right.
And, of course, that's augmented by the fact that the State Department spokeswoman, the State Department being our foreign policy arm, Heather Nauert, a couple of days ago, cited the D-Day invasion is an example of America's very strong relationship with Germany. She said, looking back in the history books, today is the 71st anniversary of the speech that announced the Marshall Plan. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the D-Day invasion. We obviously have a very long history with the government of Germany, and we have a strong relationship with the government of Germany. Of course, she came directly from Fox News to the State Department. So what's the attitude in Canada about not just the insults, but the ignorance, if you will, of top officials in this government?
Right. Well, you know, Canada enjoys a very special relationship with the United States. You know, we share what is considered to be the longest undefended border in the world. In two-way trade each day, we're close to $2 billion a day. So we have a special bond with the United States, and many Canadians have certainly expressed concern since the beginning of the 26 Republican presidential primaries and, of course, during the general election. about Donald Trump. Of course, there are some people in our country who support his positions, but the vast majority of Canadians have expressed deep concern, not only about his inability to present correct facts about the trading relationship, but his often bombastic approach to the relationship. We are, after all, one of America's closest allies. We are certainly not an adversary. And although Prime Minister Trudeau has certainly gone out of his way to try and accommodate Donald Trump, we are a sovereign nation, just like the United States. We have every right to advance our national interests, as does the United States. But I think our patience for the Trump White House, quite frankly, is wearing thin. And it's one thing to insult us. It's a whole other thing to misrepresent the historical relationship between our two great countries.
So going back to 1812 and 1814, obviously Canada didn't exist back then, but there was a U.S. incursion into Ontario, was there not? And
right.
Just explain the actual history that Donald Trump appears to have gotten wrong.
Right. So Donald Trump was referring to the War of 1812, a war that the Americans still believe they won. Of course, we know that we won that war. And he was referring to an incident following the battle at York in Ontario. And in retaliation for the attack by American soldiers on the British, British soldiers burned the White House. So it was the British soldiers, certainly not Canadian soldiers, because we were not an independent country at that point. We're a colony of Great Britain.
Right, and ever since then, Canada has fought in all the wars that the United States has fought in, I think with the exception of the Vietnam War.
That is correct.
So is there an awareness then in Canada, Donald Abelson, that maybe world leaders are basically getting burned by embracing Donald Trump? It's pretty obvious that Macron, who put on a military parade for Donald Trump and came to the White House, got a state visit, it was all touchy-feely, holding hands, etc. He's been stiffed pretty badly. Shinzo Abe's played golf a number of times, been referred to as Trump's good friend. He's furious that he's been cut out of the North Korea deal, and he's quite concerned that Trump's going to make a deal with North Korea that makes him look good, but may have no substance, or in fact, maybe worse than no deal at all. And I could go on with all of the world leaders, including Theresa May, who, of course, was the first to show up at the White House. So is there a growing awareness that, friendship with Donald Trump appears to be a one-way street?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between world leaders being friendly with Donald Trump and world leaders maintaining close relations with the United States. And you're absolutely right that the relationship between the American president and the Canadian prime minister or the British prime minister or the French president is very important in terms of setting the tone for the relationship. But the relationship between the United States and its Western European allies, and certainly with Canada and Mexico, unfolds on multiple levels. So I think what we're seeing is an effort on the part of world leaders to try and keep the relationship as strong as possible, to work with different people in the United States, in the U.S. Congress, in state legislatures, to make sure the relationship stays afloat. But having said that, it's becoming increasingly difficult, especially when the United States has a president who, by issuing a tweet or making an offhanded comment, can end up embarrassing, humiliating, frustrating, angering world leaders. And I think there are many leaders around the world, and I think we'll see this play out at the summit, who, quite frankly, are becoming increasingly frustrated and impatient with the kind of rhetoric and narrative that's coming out of the United States. We understand, certainly in Canada, that the United States has every right to pursue its own political agenda. The problem that most Canadians have with Donald Trump is with the execution and messaging of the issues that he wants to advance. So if we were able to sit down with the president and discuss in a rational, lucid, candid manner, bilateral issues like trade, like border security, the environment, and other things, we would be less upset. It's when we see tweets, when we hear comments, when the president misrepresents the nature of the relationship, that our prime minister and many other world leaders begin to get their backs up. And I think fundamentally that's the problem. It's not with the United States. It's with the current leadership.
And again, I'm speaking with Donald Abelson. He's a professor and chair of political science at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. He specializes in American politics and U.S. foreign policy. And his most recent book is Northern Lights, Exploring Think Tanks in Canada. And just adding to the list of world leaders who have been chummy with Trump and then basically gotten stiffed. Trudeau himself, of course, who just had a very testy phone call with Donald Trump and has expressed that his slapping tariffs on steel and aluminum imports or exports from Canada are insulting and unacceptable. Early on, Trudeau took Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner to a Broadway play. So it looks as if, in terms of, you know, feeling burned, French President Emmanuel Macron is already threatening to issue a rare rebuke of the United States at the G7 in Quebec that starts tomorrow. He's threatened to exclude the United States from the joint statement issued every year at the end of the G7 summit as a beginning of a pushback against Donald Trump's efforts to slap on tariffs and essentially start a trade war. So what's your expectation for what's going to be happening in Quebec City over the next 2 days, Donald?
Well, I think the world leaders who gather at the G7 summit are certainly going to do their very best to promote a common vision of key issues that bind all these countries: international trade, security, the environment, and other issues of importance. But, of course, they're going to be doing that at a time when they are feeling more and more frustration with the American president. So they're going to be walking a tightrope. And once again, it's less about the issues. It's about how Donald Trump has approached them. We should not be surprised. We saw it during the 2016 Republican presidential primaries and certainly during the general election, not to mention during his inaugural address. He made it very, very clear that it would be America first, which by necessity means that everyone else is going to be second. That in and of itself is fine, but you still have to be professional and diplomatic in terms of how you manage your relationship with your key allies. And America's interests can be advanced not necessarily by alienating or ostracizing or isolating allies, but by virtue of working closely with them and finding common ground. And I think what world leaders are experiencing is they feel as if they're being hit over the head by a mallet instead of being welcomed into concrete and constructive negotiations with the American president. So he's fully entitled to outline America's concerns, but I think most political scientists and historians would agree that far more can be accomplished if it's done in a constructive manner as opposed to trying to bully and harass and insult allies upon whom you've depended for many, many years.
So do you think that the problem is at a sort of macro level, the fact that Trump comes out of a private business and is completely transactional, doesn't seem to have any interest in human rights or even any kind of diplomatic traditions or alliances? And we have a paradox where he's making deals with despots and a really bad totalitarian leader in North Korea. And apparently after this summit with Kim Jong-un, he's likely to have another summit with Vladimir Putin. And, right, you know, just a cursory observation would indicate that it's not exactly a heavy lift. It's not difficult to make deals with despots who are international pariahs. Those kind of deals are easy to make, you know, and already Kim Jong-un's got more than he could ever bargain for simply by having the meeting being accepted on the world stage as a legitimate leader. So he's already won. So it's a very hard thing for any student of foreign policy to understand why, at a moment when we're coddling up the worst kind of despots and kleptocrats on the planet, we're stiffing our allies. But has it something to do with Trump's propensity to be transactional as opposed to have adult conversations with fellow leaders and rely on appeals to reason, data, and shared values?
Right. Well, I think there are a few things at work. One certainly is his background, the fact that, as you rightly point out, you know, he's come from the private sector, and as a CEO, he's used to certainly having his own way and issuing directives and demanding certain results. He would be far more comfortable as king of a country than as president, because he can't get everything he wants by waving a wand or issuing a directive. He works within a republic, and is a system, as you know, based on separate branches that share power. That's not something that he seems willing to embrace. I think the other issue, though, is more deep-seated in his personality. He has shown, certainly over the past year and before, that he's incredibly narcissistic. He's misogynistic. He's sexist. His comments have not only bordered on racism, they have been racist. And he has virtually no intellectual curiosity. So unlike a Barack Obama, unlike a Bill Clinton, unlike a Jimmy Carter and other presidents who clearly were students of history and wanted to make sure that at the very least they were not repeating the mistakes of the past, Donald Trump doesn't read. He doesn't like to take personal briefings. I mean, during the transition period after he won in 2016, he indicated and took great delight in announcing that he didn't need daily briefings on intelligence because, after all, he knew far more than the people around him. So if he is not prepared to listen to experts, if he's not prepared to delve deeply into the issues which not only shape the United States but countries around the globe, then he's going to continue to run into the problems that he has. And international politics is a very complicated game that plays out on multiple levels. And if you are not prepared to understand how you got to a particular place, you are going to end up repeating the kind of mistakes that he has over the past several months. So I think it's a combination of his personality and his professional background. But I think even more disturbing is the fact that he has virtually no intellectual curiosity, no willingness to listen, and that creates a very, very dangerous predicament for people who are trying to advise him.
Well, Donald Abelson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Donald Abelson, who's a professor and chair of political science at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. He specializes in American politics and U.S. foreign policy, and his most recent book is Northern Lights, Exploring Think Tanks in Canada. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing Trump's revival of the nativist and isolationist stupidity, which led to the Smoot-Hawley Act signed by President Hoover in 1930, which triggered a global depression.
I recall, I really don't know life at all.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Canada is Rodrigue Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. His books in English include The New American Empire and The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. And he has an article at his website, RodriqueTremblay100.blogspot.com, Is Donald Trump a New Herbert Hoover? Welcome to Background Briefing, Roderick Tremblay.
Good evening, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Roderick. And Donald Trump is heading for the G7 meeting in Toronto, where he'll be very much
seen. No, it will be in Quebec.
Let me start again.
Around Quebec City.
Okay, sorry. Donald Trump is heading to the G7 meeting in Quebec City, and of course he's going to be the odd man out. There's a lot of anger from most of the G7 about his essentially starting a trade war against European allies, but more importantly against Canada and Mexico. What's the mood in Canada? I mean, the problem I have with the way that this national security issue is being covered, which is Trump's justification for the 25% tariff levy on steel and the 10% levy on aluminum, is based on an old law that was passed during the Cold War. And the whole point of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 was that if there were to be a war, the United States wouldn't have the steel capacity to build up its armaments, and it would be vulnerable if steel had to travel over the oceans. So therefore we have to have protection of U.S. steel production, but it makes no sense under the national security rubric. Because if there's a war, well, of course, that's an absurdity in any case, but if there were a war, Canada's right next door. So is Mexico. There's no impediment to supplying steel and aluminum to the United States. And I think Prime Minister Trudeau tried to point that out, that there was an airfield built during World War II, specifically because it was right next to an aluminum smelter. And of course, all the aluminum, most of the aluminum supplied to U.S. aircraft manufacturers in World War II came from Canada. So let me begin. I know it's a long-winded introduction, but my sense, Roderick, is that that has never been properly explained, and even Trudeau himself didn't explain it.
Yes, I think it's a weak pretext. The only reason, logical reason to explain this reliance on that 1962 section of the Trade Act is that Mr. Trump, President Trump, doesn't want Congress to vote on his trade decisions. Because if Congress were allowed to discuss and vote, the issue may be different. If you start raising tariffs on inputs like steel and aluminum, many other American industries are using these materials to produce cars, planes, and other goods. So therefore, the fear is that if you raise these tariffs now, Mr. Trump, by his own decision, will have to raise other tariffs on cars, on planes, on other, in order to keep their competitiveness, because if the cost of the inputs goes up, that makes them less competitive. So my feeling is this is mainly a pretext, a political pretext rather than having any link to economic reality.
So, but in terms of your analogies to Herbert Hoover, obviously you can stumble into a trade war and you can feel the reciprocity building. There's so much anger from the French, the Germans, and from the Canadians because of what Trump is doing. And he seems to be much more flexible and engaged with the Chinese, who have always been the main problem in terms of international trade. And he's just made a deal with the telecom giant, which the Pentagon and the U.S. national security officials consider to be a backdoor to Chinese intelligence. And there's a connection being made to the fact that Trump, a Chinese bank, lent an Indonesian company that Trump's in business with $500 million at the time where Trump lets ZTE off the hook. So what's the mood there in terms of whether or not this thing could get out of hand?
Yeah, there's a clear danger that if President Trump were using these tariffs as a negotiating tool, that this could get out of hands because of retaliation. As soon as other countries feel that they need to retaliate because their population is asking for it, then we enter into a ping-pong game, and the danger is that the international trade will drop. And mind you, 80 years ago in 1930, the U.S. economies and many other economies were nearly half agricultural. They were not as industrialized as they are today, and they were not by far as integrated by international companies as it is the case today. So this is a dangerous game, very brinksmanship game that Mr. Trump wants to play. And he said last March that trade wars are good and they are easy to win. Well, we are talking about $20 trillion each year of international trade. This is larger, a bit larger than the U.S., the total U.S. economy. So if the apple, you can upset the apple cart very easy if you start raising taxes, big jump like 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. Mind you, the United States export more steel each year to the to Canada than Canada exports steel to the United States. The U.S. has a surplus of steel trade with Canada. And in case of aluminum, because Canada has very cheap electricity, we export more, a bit more of aluminum to the United States. But the total, as a matter of fact, the total trade with the United States on a yearly basis is a surplus for the United States. So it's very difficult to understand on an economic, from an economic point of view. I think we have to go on the political point of view to understand anything like that.
And again, I'm speaking with Roderick Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. And his books in English include The New American Empire and The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. And he has an article at his website, RodriqueTremblay100.blogspot.com. Is Donald Trump a new Herbert Hoover? And just to finish up, and you mentioned 1930. That was, of course, under President Hoover when he signed the Smoot-Hawley Act. And that was largely generated by kind of isolationism and nativism. And that appears to be exactly who Donald Trump is appealing to. I mean, everything he does is to throw red meat at this small minority of his that he's clinging to and feeding with all kinds of ignorance and quite often racism, but most in this case, complete nativist nonsense. So that's the problem, I think. And what about what the rest of the world can do? I mean, obviously, Trump doesn't even want to be at the G7 in Quebec City. It's clear that he said he doesn't want to go and he's not looking forward to it. And he won't listen to anybody at any rate. So they may want to beat up on him and try and lecture him, but he's not going to change his mind. I'm absolutely sure of that. But what might change his mind, U.S. business leaders and our craven Republican House and Senate may eventually find their backbone. What's your analysis?
Well, at least in 1930, when President Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Act on June 17, 1930, he had at least the reason that there had been a financial crash in October 1929, and the U.S. economy was in somewhat in a recession at that time. And therefore, he had a lot of pressures to protect, especially agricultural industries, by raising tariff. But when other countries decided to retaliate, then American imports not only plummeted, but the American exports also plummeted. So that was a spiral down of all economies at the same time. And that beginning recession turned into a 10-year depression, economic depression, where total global trade dropped by two-thirds. The U.S. Production dropped by nearly 50%, and the unemployment raised to the level of 25%. So to play with these very complex relations and say we can start a war and then we can stop it when we want and all that, I think it's somewhat irresponsible, and it would be good if the Senate and the House of Representatives in the U.S. had to discuss these things, because they represent a lot of companies who are involved in international trade. Mind you, American corporations, it's not like in 1930. In today's, nowadays, American corporations are in many other countries. In Canada, nearly half of industrial production is made by American companies. And on a given year, the United States, these companies bring back to the United States, for the last year that we have a figure, is 2012, is $1 trillion of profits. So it's a bit like shooting yourself in the foot when you prevent your companies from selling their goods, their technology in other countries. And it's bad for the other economies also. Their companies cannot specialize and sell to U.S. buyers. So it's very difficult to understand. I think Mr. Trump is probably alone of thinking that. And I don't understand if Mr. Kudlow, who is his economic advisor, can tell him that this is playing like with fire to try to destroy a system which has been built over the last 75 years, and mainly under the guidance of the United States government.
Well, but Trump doesn't listen to Kudlow, and he doesn't even listen to the Secretary of Treasury, Mnuchin, who's completely sycophantic. He listens to this crank, Peter Navarro. So that's not particularly promising. But when the president of the American International Automobile Dealers Association says to treat U.S. auto imports like a national security threat would be a self-inflicted economic disaster for American consumers, dealers, and dealership employees, is there any way for that message to get across? I mean, at least gets across to the Republican delegation in Michigan, I would think. I'm just trying to think about where the pushback can come, because one of the things that I think people are learning too late here in the United States is that elections have consequences. And a lot of really stupid people in this country before the election said there was no difference between Hillary Clinton and...
My own feeling is that Mr. President Trump is doing that especially for the midterm election.
Yeah.
In the Rust Belt states, and is preoccupied mainly for political his political standing. He wouldn't like to have the Democrats control both the House and the Senate, and he will become a lame duck president. So that's my interpretation of his to justify his play with international trade at this junction. Mind you, the U.S. economy is not in a recession. The U.S. economy is going pretty fine. As somebody, I think this is the president of the International Trade Association, said, President Trump will be the first politician to raise tariffs when the economy is booming. Usually, politicians under popular pressure will raise tariffs in the recession or in the depression, but not when the economy is already booming. But by doing that, though, he may bring a recession. Maybe not in the next few months, because it takes time for these taxes to run their way through the system. But 2019 and 2020 may be difficult years if Mr. Trump goes on. And he has mentioned one time that he wants to raise tariffs on European cars. And this will really transform the beginning tariffs into really a wider trade war, which will be dangerous for the United States, but dangerous for the world economy and for every other economy, industrial economy.
Right, but if he's targeting the three Rust Belt states that he won narrowly in by 70,000 votes, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, I just don't understand how raising tariffs on steel and aluminum isn't that going to backfire in the Rust Belt, where the costs are going to be passed on to people and they're going to lose jobs?
Well, it gives the impression that he's working for the workers in the steel industry, for example, or in the aluminum industry, and therefore people who don't look further than their own industry, they may profit and vote accordingly. The only problem is that these are short-term impression, but the longer-term impressions that there will be losses of jobs in other industries when the price of their inputs or materials go up. Mind you, there was a study when the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, raised a few tariffs, and the calculation that the jobs they were creating in a few in capital-intensive industries like steel and aluminum were counteracted by larger jobs of manufacturing in other industries using these materials. So Mr. Trump doesn't have any study to justify his policy. It's from the back of the seat decision. It's really improvisation. I think members of Congress are elected to represent the people and the corporations and the workers. And they should ask Mr. Trump, where are the studies that shows you that we are going to be winners if we decide to launch a trade war? And I haven't seen any study of that type, and I don't know any economist who will argue that starting a trade war is a good thing and it's easy to win. It's a bit ridiculous.
Well, Roderick Tremblay, I thank you very much for joining us. That's
welcome, and good luck.
Yes, I think that's the operative word. And again, I've been speaking with Roderick Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. His books in English include The New American Empire, and his newly released book is The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. And he has an article on his website, RoderickTremblay100.blogspot.com. Is Donald Trump a new Herbert Hoover? And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Senate today narrowly confirmed a champion of the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act to be head of civil rights at the Department of Education.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. The sword that makes the world go round, that clinking, clanking sound, can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Leave them and the kids alone. Hey, teacher, leave
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Rabbi Joseph Berman, the Government Affairs Manager at Jewish Voices for Peace, who has organized for justice and equality for Palestinians and Israelis for over a decade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rabbi Joseph Berman.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. And today, the Senate confirmed Kenneth Marcus to serve as Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights under the U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. The vote was 50-46, so it wasn't exactly a ringing endorsement. But what is your concern about Kenneth Marcus taking up this job?
Today, Marcus joins a long list of Trump appointees who will work against the very missions of the organizations that they are sworn to uphold. So Kenneth Marcus is someone who has built much of his career on coming up with legal strategies to try to suppress advocacy for Palestinian rights on college campuses. This is a lot of what he's been doing for the last number of years. And so now he's going to be in a position where he is capable of doing a lot of harm and really trying to silence human rights activists on college campuses.
So is this to do with the bill that was introduced last month by members of Congress, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which directs the Department of Education to consider a speech which they consider to be critical of Israel to be sort of fall under the rubric of anti-Semitism?
Well, that's one of the issues. He is a proponent of using a definition that intentionally conflates, on the one hand, real anti-Semitism with legitimate criticism of Israel, or real anti-Semitism and then incredibly important advocacy for Palestinian rights, which is not anti-Semitic. And so he advocates for the use of this definition. And as you said, there is now legislation moving forward in the House and the Senate that if it were passed, it would codify this definition for use by the Department of Education. It would essentially give to Kenneth Marcus even more power to suppress advocacy for Palestinian rights on college campuses. So that's one of the things that we're concerned about. But he's also seems interested in trying to defund Middle East studies programs because he doesn't agree with some of the work that is coming out of those Middle East studies departments, and we're concerned that even without that definition, he's in a position where he could say, "Oh, there's this speech that's happening on college campus. There are students who are doing things which are perfectly legal, and they're acting out of a kind of their deepest values." And he could turn around and say, oh, well, you know what, this criticism of Israel, this is actually an attack on Jewish students, and therefore it violates their civil rights. And then is in a position where he could put pressure on universities by threatening to cut their funding in order to get them to shut down student groups like Students for Justice in Palestine or Jewish Voice for Peace on those college campuses.
So why is this phenomenon happening in the first place with supporters of Israel, particularly on the right, along with the so-called Christian Zionists? I suspect Betsy DeVos herself would fit into that category, being a Christian fundamentalist that she is. And many of those luminaries in the Christian Zionist movement showed up for the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem recently, including Reverend Hagee and another a pastor who themselves had made outrageous anti-Semitic remarks. So I guess my question to you, since you work in this field, Rabbi Joseph Berman, is why does a country so militarily powerful as Israel, with such enormous support here in the United States in both the House and the Congress, why is it insecure about wanting to have a debate vis-a-vis Israel's rights and Palestinian rights and make this debate free and open? Why does it want to basically shut down any possibility of expressing any sympathy for the Palestinians, who, as far as I can tell, are incredibly weak, beleaguered, and under siege? Did we lose you, Rabbi?
I think this is the way that politics really works, you know. And so, I mean, I think they're doing everything they can to try to silence those who are critical of Israeli policies, silence those who are advocating for Palestinian rights. You know, we've seen in the last many weeks, we've seen unarmed protesters in Gaza marching as part of the Great March of Return, who are marching for an end to the siege on Gaza, who are marching for their right to return home. We've seen them killed, gunned down by snipers, by Israeli snipers. Over 100 have been killed, somewhere around 10,000, more than 10,000 injured. Absolutely horrific, absolutely horrific. And you know, there are so many of us around the world, in this country, who are just outraged. I mean, including many within the Jewish community who are just outraged, and who really think that U.S. policy needs to change, because it's really the United States government that is playing a role of enabling what is happening by supporting inequality, by supporting displacement, by supporting occupation. That's what we need to do, is we need to advocate to try to change U.S. policy. And so I think you could say, why is that speech trying to be suppressed? And I think that's because we're starting to be effective. The movement is growing. People are opening their eyes and starting to speak out.
And again, I'm speaking with Rabbi Joseph Berman, Government Affairs Manager at Jewish Voice for Peace, who has organized for justice and equality for Palestinians and Israelis for over a decade. But your organization itself, from what I recall, did not the Israeli government ban the entry into Israel? I think it's the head of your organization. Is that right?
The Israeli government has banned a number of organizations from their leadership or staff from entering the country. Yeah, that's correct.
And these are people with families in Israel, are they not?
That's right. There are many people, especially Palestinians, also Jews, who have now been banned from entering the country. So they're in a position where, yeah, they can't go to visit their families. You know, and it's, I think, also worth noting that there have been many Palestinians in that position for decades and decades of being unable to return to their homes, or unable to visit family members and be with them.
So my understanding is that there is some pushback. And as I mentioned in the beginning, Rabbi Berman, the vote today to approve or to confirm Kenneth Marcus as the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights under U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, the vote was 50-46. So there's obviously some opposition to this. And the ACLU is also, on Monday, sent a letter to Congress opposing the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. Can you give us a sense of what pushback there is? And maybe some of our listeners might want to join in this, because it's pretty, seems like a pretty slippery slope, is it not, where you suddenly, if you use your First Amendment rights to criticize Israel's politics, you could be branded as an anti-Semite.
Well, so there's a lot of pushback on Marcus, and he was opposed by many different civil rights or human rights organizations, Jewish organizations, opposed by the NAACP, by the Human Rights Campaign, the National Center for Transgender Equality, opposed by the National Council of Jewish Women, Southern Poverty Law Center. The list goes on and on, and that's because his positions on many things are deplorable. He's someone who is not actually going to protect the civil rights of students, which is what this position is supposed to be for. He's actually going to undermine those rights. I mean, he's advocated for weakened Title IX protection, right, which would undermine protection for victims of sexual assault on college campuses. He's tried to undermine protection for LGBTQ individuals by arguing against the protection of sexual orientation under federal law. Yeah, what we saw today was basically a party line vote. Because I think it's it's clear that this is not someone who will actually protect the civil rights of college students, and he's somebody who's, as we spoke about earlier, is a real threat to kind of basic First Amendment rights on college campuses. So he's already been confirmed. What we need to do over the next 2.5 years, while he's likely to be in this position, is really watch closely. And I think there are going to be fights coming up that we're going to need to engage in to protect our students. And as you mentioned, the so-called Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, I think that title is misleading. It's not actually about anti-Semitism. It's really, I like to call it the Silencing Students Act. That has not passed, and there is indeed a great deal of opposition to it. And so that's something where you can pick up the phone and call your members of Congress in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate and say, hey, listen, don't co-sponsor this legislation. I want you to oppose it. It's not really about anti-Semitism. There's real anti-Semitism in the world. It's scary. We need to fight it. It's a real threat. This legislation will actually make it harder to fight anti-Semitism because it's not really about anti-Semitism. It's about silencing advocacy for Palestinian rights. It's about silencing legitimate criticism of Israel. And so it's not too late to defeat that legislation.
Well, there have been efforts to silence people and performers who have either been critical of Israel or advocated for a boycott of Israel, specifically Roger Waters of Pink Floyd. Officials in Nassau County, New York, tried to stop a local arena from having Pink Floyd perform. And then earlier this year, Florida officials tried to prevent Lorde from performing in Miami and Tampa after she had canceled concerts in Israel. So that seems to be happening. Is your organization picking up the fight against that? Because that seems to be a fairly well-organized effort to, again, silence critics of Israel and punish them for not performing there.
You know, I think that our job is to be very clear about what we stand for, and to be clear that we're not going to be silenced, that we stand for equality and human rights and dignity, and that we are working for a just and lasting peace. And to be clear about that, and to refuse to be silenced. And so it's really all of our responsibility to do that together. And for others who say, well, might be listening, say, well, I don't know what I think about this, or maybe I disagree about that. Well, that's okay. We're not going to agree on everything. At the very least, I think something that we can agree on is the importance of protecting the First Amendment and protecting our right to free speech. And so that includes boycotting because of our conscience. That includes going out and protesting in the street. So whether it's on a college campus, whether it's an entertainer, right? We have a right to free speech, and that needs to be upheld.
Well, some of what Marcus said in being questioned by the Senate both yesterday and today, and of course he was narrowly confirmed today, are pretty alarming. I mean, first of all, he's serving Secretary of Education, who doesn't believe in public schools, and he appears to be getting the job of Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights and yet doesn't appear to believe in civil rights. I mean, he is, for example, he supports Betsy DeVos's attack on sexual assault survivors. He doesn't think Title VI protects undocumented students. He doesn't think that Title IX protects LGBTQ students. He thinks that affirmative action is reverse discrimination. He thinks that sexist stereotypes are legitimate basis for offering single-sex education. And he doesn't believe in disparate impact, unintentional discrimination. And I could go on, but is this really what it appears to be, yet another example of Donald Trump putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank?
That's exactly right. I am afraid this is somebody who everything that we know about him indicates that he's likely to work against the very mission of the Office of Civil Rights, against the very mission of the Department of Education. So we're going to have to be vigilant over these next 2.5 years to be fighting back.
And what can we do to fight back? I mean, this is the problem with Donald Trump and the daily dose of doom that he provides us all with. I mean, my job as a journalist trying to cover him is exhausting because you get whipsawed all the time. There's a certain exhaustion that sets in, not to mention a despair, because on a daily basis, he's kind of the reality TV president who throws out kind of stunts. It's government by stunt and by reality TV phony fake drama. So to some extent, we're manipulated in the very position of having to cover him. You continually are covering the outrages, and quite often a lot slips under the radar because of that, or you're covering the stunt as opposed to the substance of what is being done or undone, which is more often the case. So what's your prescription here in closing, Rabbi Joseph Berman, for how we can sustain this fight, not get discouraged by the constant distraction, and yet recognize the damage that's being done and do everything we can to undo that damage?
Well, I think that that's both a political and a spiritual question. I think we need to identify our sources of strength. We need to identify our sources of hope. We need to understand that we are part of a struggle for a better world that started before we came into being and that will continue to exist after we exist. And it is a gift to be able to engage in that struggle. And so we have to figure out, how do we shift our mentality into that place? How do we find people to work with, to be in community with, to be in relationship with, where we can support one another and take collective action? And when we start to despair, we can remind one another about why we are doing this work. We can remind one another what our sources of strength are and our sources of hope, because we're not alone. We're not alone. And things may be bleak, but that does not mean that that's the way that they always will be. And so our job is to decide that we want to be part of creating something better for the future, and to join hands and march toward that.
Well, Rabbi Joseph Berman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Rabbi Joseph Berman, who's a government affairs manager at Jewish Voice for Peace, who has organized for justice and equality for Palestinians and Israelis for over a decade. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.